Officers carrying business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention in the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We'll begin with two admissions for the bar. Judge Ripple.
Thank you, Judge Easterbrook. Ms. Tara Cochran would please come to the podium. Judge Easterbrook and Judge Williams, I have the honor of moving this morning the admission of my law clerk, Tara M. Cochran. Ms. Cochran is a member of the bar of the state of Illinois. She did her undergraduate work at Denison University in Granville, Ohio. She graduated summa cum laude from that institution and then went on to Valparaiso University School of Law, where she also graduated summa cum laude. She has served the court with distinction and will be leaving us soon to practice with the firm of Sidley & Austin here in Chicago. So I'm indeed pleased to move her admission to the bar.
Thank you. Judge Ripple, your motion is granted. We will welcome you to our bar and wish you a long and successful career, which we trust will not commence until the clerkship ends. You'll hold on for just a second. There's a second motion for admission. Mr. Vincent.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Josh Vincent. It's with great pleasure that I'd like to move the admission this morning of Mr. Clint Carnes, the fiancé of Sarah Cochran. Mr. Carnes is a graduate of Indiana University, where he graduated with distinction. He also went to law school at Valparaiso University, where he graduated cum laude. Mr. Carnes has been an associate at my law firm for the past 3 years. He has distinguished himself there as one of our most highly regarded and sought-after associates. It's hard for me to get into too much work because everybody else places so many demands upon his time, but I'm hopeful that I will get him to do an appeal here someday.
Thank you very much. Your motion is granted. We welcome you as well, and so far as we're concerned, we'd be happy to have you start practicing immediately. So if the two of you would step over, please, and take the oath. First case of the morning, Nast against Schwebke.
Yes. May it please the court, I'm Jody Schmalzer, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Wisconsin, and I represent the defendant appellants in this case, six current or former psychologists employed at the Wisconsin Resource Center. In this appeal, the defendant psychologist challenged the district court's denial of qualified immunity relating to their involvement in the development and implementation of secure management plans that utilize seclusion and restraint for patients that exhibited dangerous behaviors that posed a risk to the safety of others and the institution. The district court erred because even if these secure management plans violated substantive due process rights under the professional judgment standards set forth in Youngberg, such rights were not clearly established at the time that these plans were developed. Government officials performing discretionary functions are shielded from damage liability insofar as their conduct does not violate clearly established rights. And when we look at whether or not clearly established rights were violated, we look to federal law. Those rights must be federal, statutory, or constitutional rights. The burden is on the plaintiff to demonstrate that the error was clearly established. And when we look to whether or not it's clearly established, the Saucier case tells us to that right must be clearly established in a more particularized and hence more relevant sense, that the contours of that right must be sufficiently clear that a reasonable official would understand that what he was doing violated a right. In this case, there was a dispute of fact as to whether or not the substantive due process rights of these patients were violated. That dispute of fact does not preclude a ruling on qualified immunity. However, this court held in the Green case that even if there's a dispute of material facts as to the merit of a substantive due process claim or a constitutional claim, does not preclude a ruling on qualified immunity. The court looks to the record de novo. and determines whether or not it can decide immunity questions without resolving disputed questions of fact, and the defendant submits that this is such a case. The district court erred in its holding denying qualified immunity because the cases cited in support of its holding do not clearly establish that secure management plans and the secure management plans implemented in this case violated substantive due process rights of these patients. In support of its holding and its denial of qualified immunity, the district court cited two cases, Wells v. Franzen, which this court decided, and the Thomas S. case of the Fourth Circuit. It also cited Youngberg, which stands for the general finding of a right to undue bodily restraint for a mental health patient. First of all, the Youngberg case in and of itself is not enough to clearly establish the right at issue in this case. Youngberg is the general proposition, stands for the general proposition that a mental health patient has the right to be free from undue bodily restraint. It did not hold that the restraint of that individual, Mr. Romeo, violated professional judgment standards. It did not hold that it was such a substantial departure from accepted standards or judgment or practice that situation of restraining a...
isn't that your very problem here? The plaintiffs have introduced evidence suggesting that the defendant's approach is a violation of professional standards. And as you recognize, that's... we have a disputed issue of fact on that question, which we're not at liberty to resolve. So then we have the question whether, even when the defendant's behavior violates accepted professional standards, they can go ahead. And one would think on the basis of Youngberg that the answer is no.
Nothing in the Youngberg decision, Your Honor, clearly establishes a violation of due process. In fact, the Youngberg court remanded the issue of whether or not restraining this 33-year-old individual who had...
Yes, there was a question in Youngberg about what professional standards do require, as there is such a question here. And we can't resolve it at this stage.
We can't resolve it, but what we can resolve is that such a substantial departure from that standard, or what would equate a... whether or not it's clearly established that the departure in this case was such a substantial... was...
But that can't... there is no legal clear establishment of what the professional standards require. The legal rule is that professional standards control. That's clearly established by Youngberg. What more has to be clearly established?
Youngberg, and I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, I don't think it establishes that...
Well, then let's pursue that a little while. Suppose you could find a rogue psychologist who believe that electroshock therapy is just the ticket for sexually dangerous persons, or prefrontal lobotomies, or something like that. There's a range in every profession. I'm sure you could find somebody, maybe somebody just let out of an asylum himself, who still is a fancier of those approaches, and he then implements them in the state's prisons. Is he immune from all liability for doing that, even though 99.99% of all psychologists would say that this man is a brute inflicting pain for no reason?
He's probably not immune, Your Honor, because we have clearly established cases that...
But there are no cases on that. There are no cases because no prior brutes have been found. But there is a standard, the Youngberg standard.
And the court in the LeDuc case did grant qualified immunity for a physician's imposing electroshock treatment on a non-consensual patient. They did grant qualified immunity in that case. This court did. However, I believe what Your Honor is trying to allude to is the decision by the Supreme Court in the Hope case.
I'm not trying to allude to anything. I'm trying to put you a problem. Is it your view that anybody with a degree is immune from liability, no matter what he does? Because since he has a degree, he's a professional, and if in his own opinion it's entirely appropriate to isolate people or inflict pain or, you know, drop tables on their chests or do anything, as long as he's got a degree, he's a professional, and therefore there can't possibly be any damages liability.
There are cases, and the Supreme Court has acknowledged, where there's such an obvious clarity of that right or departure from that right that you would not need closely analogous cases.
That was the district court's finding here, that it was perfectly obvious to any professional, given the plaintiff's evidence, that the behavior, that the supposed treatment here was unjustified. Now, that may be wrong, right? That's a litigable question. But if we take that to be true, you see what follows.
And the cases cited by the court, the district court, in asserting that such a right was obvious or clearly established without having the exact factual propositions in a prior case, those do not clearly establish or do not put these psychologists on notice that these secure management plans, and this, although there's some disputes about the record as to how these were implemented and the conditions that actually occurred when they were under the secure management plans, the plans themselves are not in dispute. These are not plans that lock them up without evaluation or without corresponding with treatment.
As I recall, both of you had about two experts, am I correct?
We had three experts, Your Honor, and the plaintiffs had two.
Okay. Suppose a trier of fact were to decide that your experts are flat out lying and thought that the experts of the other side were telling the absolute truth. Isn't that a possibility if this thing goes to trial?
It's a possibility, Your Honor.
Okay. In other words, there was a dispute between people on the issue of whether the formulators of this plan exercised professional judgment.
That's correct.
Isn't that the end of the case?
It's not, because whether or not this case involves such a substantial departure from professional judgment is not clearly established. We take that and we assume for this qualified immunity analysis that they did violate the professional judgment standard, that they did violate substantive due process rights, because that's disputed.
The testimony of the plaintiff's experts goes one step further and says, flat out, there wasn't even an exercise of professional judgment on the part of these people.
Actually, Your Honor, Dr. Metzner did not state that. He stated that there was an exercise of professional judgment, but that's
just... What did the other one say?
Dr. Tardif stated that it was that the exercise of judgment by these psychologists so substantially departed from the accepted standards from the American Psychiatric Association and the Joint Commission for the Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations that it showed to be not an exercise of judgment at all. However, reliance on those standards and a departure from those standards is in no way clearly established in our cases that would equal a lack of professional judgment, especially in this case where our psychologists' exercise of professional judgment required that they, or in their exercise of professional judgment, required that they depart from those standards.
Well, let's talk about the type of individuals they were. You know, it's your position, I think, that the plaintiffs needed to be treated differently because they were sexually violent under 980, right?
It's relevant, I think, Your Honor, for the qualified immunity analysis.
Right, but weren't all of your security concerns unrelated to the sexually violent classification and actually consistent with the antisocial or potentially violent behavior that one might find in dealing with traditional patients in an institutional setting?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because at least under Wisconsin law, someone with an antisocial personality disorder would not have been committed involuntarily. This was the first time that these psychologists had to deal with individuals who were in full control of their behaviors. And that's what made it difficult to assess their dangerousness, because they weren't sure if they were putting up, that they were superficially showing a control of their behavior and that they weren't going to be aggressive or commit any more assaults. But yet once they were released from that, and that's the standard under the American Psychiatric Association Task Force procedures, is once they show that they're calmed down, that they'd be released, that was the concern of our psychologist, that because they had that full control versus, you know, a mental health patient with schizophrenia or with a mental disability who may not be in full control of those behaviors, whose illness controls those behaviors. That was a concern with these psychologists and why these individuals necessitated in their judgment a plan of more of a phased plan where they would have attainable goals because they demonstrated that their behavior could match those goals and that they were no longer dangerous.
So their sexually violent classification really didn't have any impact? Is that what you're saying?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the courts have recognized, even though Dr. Tardif didn't, that these individuals as a class are more dangerous. Although they're sexually dangerous, they are sexually violent. They're violent individuals, and they're substantially likely, because of their mental disorder and their personality disorder, substantially likely to commit future acts of violence. So I think that it's relevant in that respect, as this was the situation put on these psychologists. They had never before been in that situation with these type of individuals, and this was the plan in their judgment that they thought would address these behaviors and create a safe environment for these folks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Ms. Christensen.
May it please the court. I'm Kristen Kirschensteiner, and I represent the plaintiffs, all the plaintiffs in this matter. The facts in this case and the arguments of the defendant's counsel do not warrant carving this case out as an exception of the Supreme Court's holding in Youngberg. The brief provided a landslide of facts. When you sort through them all and come up with those which are material to this appeal, the most important point to be made is that the plaintiffs were involuntarily committed mental health patients who were being treated by the defendant psychologist. And it is this relationship of the plaintiffs to the defendants that's key and operative in this appeal. As treating psychologists, the defendants subjected the plaintiffs to secure management plans. Part of the secure management plan at issue here is the seclusion and restraint of the plaintiffs for 22 hours a day, depending on their level of the plan. 24 hours on weekends, interestingly enough. Occasionally they were naked in their cells. At least one occasion there was no toilet provided, and the plaintiff was handed a plastic bag and told to use that. When they were out of their cells, they were in anything from handcuffs to what are called a Mendota belt, which is a belt around the waist and then some chains out here to allow a little bit of movement of the arms. The plaintiffs have alleged in their complaint that the defendant's actions violated their constitutionally protected liberty interests in to reasonably non-restrictive conditions of confinement, as articulated in Youngberg. Now, this is strictly a federal due process, substantive due process claim. There are some actions which are so wrongful to government actors that regardless of the procedures implemented to the fairness of the procedures to implement them, they are still considered violations. Under Youngberg, the professional judgment standard was determined to be the appropriate test for balancing the individual patient's liberty interest against the state's asserted reason for that restraint of liberty. There are two ways that the actions of the defendants violated the Youngberg standard. In some instances, I think that these defendants didn't exercise professional judgment at all and abdicated the exercise of that judgment in favor of administrative directive. There are several places in the record where one or more of the defendants indicated that the particular patient didn't meet the standard for seclusion, but they were secluding him anyway based on administrative directive. In other instances, and probably the more general consideration is that these plans, these secure management plans and the seclusion and restraint under them were such a substantial departure from professional norms that to indicate that there was no professional judgment exercised. According to the plaintiff's experts, there are three basic ideas that carry through what this professional judgment would include. You should only use seclusion and restraint in an emergency situation. You should use it for the shortest time possible, and when the individual becomes calm and appropriate, he should be out of seclusion and restraint, and then seclusion and restraint should not be used for punishment or as a deterrent consequence. All of these were violated by the defendant. Additionally, this court in, very court in Wells v. Franzen has had indicated that this would be fair warning, jumping ahead to my whole argument, that Youngberg and Wells gave the defendants fair warning that their actions violated the plaintiff's rights under the 14th Amendment. The defendant's arguments for qualified immunity fall into two general categories. First, they claim that plaintiffs are such unique and special mental health patients that they don't fall under Youngberg. This argument may carry the day to justify differential treatment when they're defending an equal protection argument or procedural due process claim, but it just can't cut it when you're talking about accepting these judgments from the Youngberg standard. What do they base their non-traditional label on? First, they suggest diagnosis, that traditional mental health patients are incapable of the violence due to their impairment. Youngberg, in the Youngberg case, that particular person being restrained was in fact violent. That's the point of restraint. That's the point of seclusion, to deal with emergency situations. Additionally, one of the plaintiffs has a traditional diagnosis of major mental illness, and is diagnosed as bipolar, among other things. Does that mean he's entitled to different rights than the other plaintiffs? Finally, the mental health field has a habit of changing diagnoses, having multiple diagnoses. This might encourage staff to let the desire to restrict a patient's rights drive that diagnosis. Second, the defendants turned to legal status as Chapter 980 committees to justify their non-traditional label. In the Wisconsin Supreme Court, in State v. Post and also State v. Carpenter, recognized the status of 980 committees as civil patients entitled to treatment. Specifically, State v. Post, the court recognized the applicability of Youngberg to this type of involuntary patient. The important point is the relationship between the patient and the mental health professional, and not the legal status of that patient. More importantly, Wells and Franzen, when this exact court was applied the Youngberg standard to a convicted prisoner, obviously a very different legal standard than traditional mental health patients. Finally, the defendants claim that the plaintiffs are unique because they are inherently more dangerous as sex offenders than individuals committed under other mental health laws. This is an untenable distinction between the plaintiffs and other dangerous individuals. Other mental health laws include such things as not guilty by reason of insanity or unfit to stand trial, where there may be some terrible criminal act underlying the ultimate commitment. The Youngberg court did acknowledge the need of the institution to restrain the individuals for safety reasons and arrived at the professional judgment standard as a way to balance these competing interests. Finally, as a fair warning, the defendants try and justify their claim for qualified immunity by stating that the law, including Youngberg, is too general, vague, or simply scant to give defendants fair warning. However, in Hope v. Pelsner, the Supreme Court noted that for the purposes of qualified immunity, fair warning is not measured by the quantity of the case law, but rather the obvious clarity of the application of the decisional law to the conduct in question. Nonetheless, defendants allege in their brief that Youngberg is just too general to give fair warning. They seem to want very specific, concrete direction as to the content of their professional judgment. They claim that they didn't know that violating the psychiatric association standards, the institution rules, the statutes, the regulations, the judicial standards.
Surely that's right, isn't it? The Constitution of the United States differs from whatever today's standards of the American Psychiatric Association are.
Correct. It's a two-step process.
In order to amend the Constitution, you have to go through two-thirds approval by the Congress and three-quarters approval by the states, and not just the Board of Directors of the American Psychiatric Association.
Yeah, absolutely. The point, though, is it's a two-step analysis, that the violation of the Constitution occurs when the action taken by the defendants is such a substantial departure from professional norms as to be outside that umbrella of protection. There's no one particular thing that's going to say, aha, this is the sole criteria. But in establishing the evidence, in establishing the body of evidence, you have to look, it's a fluid sort of thing. In answer to your question that you posed to defendants' counsel, if there was an epiphany in the psychiatric community and a brand and eating chocolate was going to cure you, then that would have to be reflected in a change in professional judgment. That's not the case here. Our experts have clearly stated that the actions taken, including and restraining the plaintiff for days, weeks, and months, was beyond the pale of the professional judgment standard. And Hope doesn't require exact factual parallels to impart fair warning, but it's held that a general constitutional rule that can apply to give fair warning when it's obvious clarity, and there's obvious clarity to the defendant's situation. The point is that professional judgment is designed to provide professional latitude. And it's not for the courts to interfere with the running of an institution from on high, but to only ensure that there was some professional judgment exercised. Finally, the defendants have cited several procedural due process cases to provide some sense that there's a flux or unclarity in the law. And these procedural due process, state-created liberty interest cases just have no application or relevance to the case at bar. Finally, on the issue of supplemental jurisdiction, if for some reason the plaintiff's 1983 claims are dismissed, the complementary Chapter 51 claim should be left to the district court. They have yet as the district court passed on those claims. This is a four-year-old case. The discovery's done. Summary judgments are concluded. It's ready for trial, and substantial resources have already been committed. The facts are the same. The restraint and seclusion is the subject of both federal and state claims, and therefore fairness to all the parties would suggest it's time to resolve this case and conclude it at the district court level. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anything further, Ms. Schnelzer?
Professional judgment was exercised in this case. The issue is whether or not it so substantially departed from accepted standards as to equal that no professional judgment, in fact, was exercised. That's the dispute. What's not disputed is that there's no law. If these psychologists had these handful of cases that the court delivered to them in its opinion denying qualified immunity, would they be on fair notice, or would a reasonable psychologist know that these plans violated substantive due process? And I submit that they don't. And the three points that Attorney Kirschensteiner mentioned about that the court highlighted in its decision was that these standards set forth that they can't be secluded unless it's an emergency situation. Well, in that situation, one of the cases cited by it would undermine one of the cases cited by the district court in its own opinion, which is the King case, where for sexually violent offenders they implemented sanctions by use of seclusion and restraint, and that was upheld by the First Circuit. In the Fuhrman case, in the district court case that ultimately got to this court, the court held that this same provision in the 5161, the use of seclusion and restraint, did not create an atypical, or actually this court held that the use of leg restraints and arm restraints did not create an atypical significant hardship for 980s given the conditions of their confinement. Given those sort of cases, these psychologists would not be unnoticed by their plan.
Thank you. The case is taken under advisement. Our next case this morning.